Hello and welcome to the MDR Podcast, the podcast channel of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. Today we are going to continue with a special series on the highlights of the MDS Congress 2024. We are going to discuss about what happened on the fourth day of the Congress on September the 30th. To do so, we have the pleasure to have with us Professor Hugh Morris from the University College of London in the UK. Welcome, Hugh, and thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we've been doing this for a few days now, and we like to start normally with the plenaries. Uh-huh. What would you say the best things about the plenaries yesterday were?
Yeah, we had another great day at the conference yesterday, and there's lots to watch on catch up for people listening to this to dial in. So obviously one of the highlights of the morning session was Dinah Katabi's lecture, which was it created a lot of interest, I think, amongst MDS members. So essentially, it was continuing the theme of AI-driven technology in medicine. And essentially, she's developed a sort of Wi-Fi-based monitor system, which sits in people's homes. Wi-Fi, as everyone knows, goes through walls, goes through floors. And it really like radar. It can detect movement that happens in people, in individuals, in the space. And it was quite sort of mind-blowing what she was able to do with this, in particular sort of monitoring patients with Parkinson's, monitoring multiple individuals in a house at the same time, and actually then using sort of AI machine learning based approaches to look at data, particularly related to sleep and changes in sleep pattern. And this seems to be, you know, quite powerful and quite accurate in actually diagnosing people with Parkinson's. And actually what I find particularly amazing was that there was a very high correlation between sort of AI derived sleep measures, particularly, you know, changes in REM sleep, and people's severity. So one of the things I'm really interested in is progression in Parkinson's, how we measure that. And obviously you've got all these scales and they kind of change, but the idea that you can have a sort of remote monitoring system that can measure sleep, that tracks people's progressions, I think is very exciting. I think one of the things with like digital technology in movement disorders is, of course, it's been based on watches, phones, you have to charge them up, they lose their battery, they have to be connected to a network. But of course, if you have a Wi-Fi device in your home, you don't have to think about it. It's like it can monitor you. And of course, most people have a Wi-Fi transmitter in their home that they're used to as a sort of technology to get their internet signal. So it's something that potentially could be a lot more reliable than like smartphones or watches and all these other devices that are being done.
Yeah, that's great. And actually, the usability is definitely going to be much higher yes. than whatever you have to charge or do a specific task with. So that is indeed... exciting.
Yes.
Any other plenary you wanted to comment about?
I will say in terms of the discussion, I think that one of the things that came up with Dinah's talk from MDS members was about privacy issues and what happens if you pick up signals from other people who are in the house who are not part of your study. What do you do with their data? What if you pick up something that indicates that they're at risk of developing a condition? They're not, you know, they're just, it's just like the, you know, it's like a visitor or a friend who comes to the house. So obviously, there's quite a lot, as with all of these sort of technology things, there's quite a lot of ethical and kind of like things that need to be considered in terms of how they're used. But I think it looks like a very exciting technology. I think there were a few other things in the plenary session. So it went through and then into sort of clinical breakthroughs. So again, a lot of excitement with Britt Bolinow's presentation, which was about looking at plasma protein measures. So a lot of the biomarker work that has been done so far has been on sort of set panels of proteins, but this was using a mass spectrometry approach, which is kind of like hypothesis-free. And you can look at potentially every peptide fragment, proteins that kind of in the plasma. And that was used with Parkinson's patients versus healthy controls to ultimately, through several rounds, to derive 23 differentially expressed proteins that were in the blood that distinguished between Parkinson's healthy controls. Again, using a machine learning AI type approach to go through multiple rounds of training and validation of these. What was particularly interesting was that it was then applied to patients with REM sleep behavior disorder and suggested there's a plasma protein signature of Parkinson's that kind of existed in RBD patients who went on to convert like 7 years before they converted to Parkinson's. So the idea that there may be a blood signature that might be a very useful predictor. Obviously, flavor of the year is like, or a couple of years is like SAA and these seed amplification assays. But obviously, this is a different approach looking at, you know, proteins within the blood. And of course, it doesn't need CSF. It can be taken from a simple blood draw. You know, I think like with a lot of these things, this needs to be validated in new cohorts. In fact, the proteins that came up, they tended to show an as I understood it, they were really showing an inflammatory signature. There's like an inflammatory profile, which is part of the prodrome of Parkinson's and is kind of predictive of Parkinson's. So again, that may give some mechanistic kind of insights into what's happening as people progress into Parkinson's from a prodromal state.
Yes, I've heard a lot of people like that session a lot because of, well, what you were highlighting. The two things was the possible clinical application, but also what we can learn from what actually AI was able to pick in these peptides.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So then changing tack slightly, a massive unmet need in movement disorders clinics is patients with functional disorders. Mm-hmm. We do not have very good treatment for them. Actually, we find it difficult, or there's a shortage of like specialist clinics and therapy services for patients with functional disorders. And so, you know, clearly if we're going to have better treatment for patients, we need to have a good evidence base to allow us to provide the best treatment for patients with functional disorders. So Pablo Mir presented a great talk on the study that he'd done, which was a randomized controlled trial of physiotherapy and CBT, so intensive therapy, both physical and cognitive behavioral therapy for patients with functional disorders as compared to standard of care, which I think was telephone support. So actually, there's quite a short duration of treatment, but there seemed to be, you know, benefits in quality of life, benefits in motor function measured with the SF-36 that were sort of seen 3-5 months after the randomization. So, and the effects were, you know, quite significant improvements in people who had the active treatment. So of course, it depends your healthcare system, but if you like saying, right, we need to allocate a physiotherapist to this or cognitive therapy, it kind of provides some evidence that can support providing those sorts of interventions. And I think it's obviously an underlooked area, which I think a lot of the challenge with how we're going to manage functional patients. So I think that's something which potentially is going to have impact in and how people do clinical practice around the world. So,
yes, indeed. I mean, that's definitely an unmet need. And I agree that the presentation was great. And if it can help on a long run to have enough evidence to start using this more widely, because there are, as you were mentioning, there are already some places where there are programs which are very good, but we need evidence for this to be used on a larger scale.
Yeah. So then the next sort of plenary session was multiple pathologies common, diagnostic and therapeutic implications. I think it says it's the title. Title says what it was about.
Yes.
You know, when we were at medical school, we're like taught that you have one clinical syndrome and there's one disease, there's one pathology that relates to that. And I think that's our mindset. You've either got Parkinson's or you've got PSP or you've got Alzheimer's disease. And I work at Queen's Square. We have a brain bank meeting. Actually, the commonest diagnosis in the Queen's Square brain bank meeting is multiple pathologies. It's actually the commonest. And every month we kind of go, well, that was quite difficult. There was more than one thing. But of course, actually, when you step back and we talk to pathologists, and we had two great presentations from Irina Alufazov from Uppsala and Tom Beach from Banner, we look at these big population-based pathology studies. That's actually the norm, that people have multiple pathologies in their brain. Mm. And actually, these exist in background populations. So people who are not diagnosed with dementia or movement disorders have multiple pathologies that become more common with aging. So tau, TDP-43, amyloid, synuclein, these are present in the brains of, if you like, clinically unaffected elderly people, and they become more common with age. So the Uppsala study was I think actually 5% of autopsies from their hospital series went for a detailed neuropathologic examination. I think maybe 20% of those patients actually had dementia, but in the non-demented series, almost all of them had tau pathology. Many of them had this pure tau pathology, this primary age-related tauopathy. Some of them had actually met criteria for Alzheimer's, so they both amyloid and tau, but they were clinically unaffected as far as we know. So it kind of, I think that this is really important in understanding neurodegeneration. It's really important understanding how we might develop treatments. And I think it's really important understanding biomarkers, so how we interpret biomarker data. Tom Beach with the Banner study talked a bit more about how it correlates with clinical outcomes and sort of talked about how both synuclein load and Alzheimer's load contributes to dementia together. And that in, for example, Parkinson's patients, well, in the controls, people who don't have movement or cognitive disorder, if you look at people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, in each decade, the background pathology increases. And if you look at people with Parkinson's disease, they have the same trajectory, but just to a greater extent. So there's like an interaction between the synuclein and the other pathologies. So they kind of increase it. The trend is the same with age, but it's kind of shifted up a notch on the graph. And I mean, if people are doing catch up, I'd really look at both the talks, but particularly the slides that Tom was showing about the background pathology and how that occurs in people with Parkinson's disease. And of course, you know, this is, and of course, he actually sees cases coming up with incidental PSP pathology that come up as well in the general population, and really specific pathologies that are actually existing within the unaffected population. I think there are some really important clues there in terms of neurodegeneration. He also really highlighted something which I think is a bit overlooked, is the impact of vascular pathology. Mm-hmm. So people have infarcts, amyloid angiopathy, white matter rarefaction. That all increases the risk of dementia and Parkinson's. And this, you know, this has been published, but we've kind of overlooked this a bit. And of course, it suggests that actually potentially intensive blood pressure modification or statins might be helpful in preventing dementia in people with Parkinson's, which is, you know, a really important message from pathology that maybe we haven't explored as much as we should have done. So Jaco Compte then sort of brought things together. And again, he highlighted the interaction between Alzheimer's pathology and synuclein pathology and Parkinson's dementia. And actually the best predictor in the previous study he'd done, the best predictor was a combination of both things together in terms of predicting dementia. So both things are important in many patients. He highlighted what this means for biomarker things, and actually there might be a number of presentations through the meeting addressing this, including Ejibari from our group who with the junior award talk about the background synuclein positivity that's present in patients with PSP, which matches the pathology. And in fact, in studies looking at PSP patients, between 10 and 40% of patients in the studies that Jaco discussed have some background synuclein pathology. So that kind of suggests in a way that the synuclein test is not going to be very good at distinguishing between PSP and Parkinson's disease. But it is giving us some really important information about co-pathology, the effect of co-pathology, the biology of the disease, what's happening. So Jaco kind of, and he talked a lot more then about how this affects clinical outcomes. He talked then about what that might mean for treatment, and talks about maybe thinking, well, we have antibodies against these things. None of them obviously have been, you know, proven.
Validated,
if you like. But he sort of looked, it was slightly sort of science fiction, looking at the future, like maybe there'll be a future time when we look at people's biomarker profile and their proteins, and we give them maybe some synuclein antibody, some tau antibody, or some sort of cocktail.
A personalized cocktail,
exactly. Yeah. So he made that, and then he rode back a bit from that, saying, of course, I'm not suggesting this should happen, but of course, that is the sort of logical conclusion of that. So that's pretty exciting, I think, to have that information about what's going on in people's brains. So yeah, so I think it's very exciting. It was a great session.
And I think the session was good also because it went from, well, as you said before, we've been knowing this for a long time.
Yeah.
But we greatly overlooked all of this information.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, you were mentioning your meetings at the Brain Bank, right?
Yep.
And you know that the most common thing is to have multiple pathology.
Yes.
But we have been looking and publishing things, calling them synucleinopathy, tauopathy, and so on.
Yeah.
And now that we have tools, namely the sitting assays or the antibodies, things that might actually be applied in research and clinical practice.
Yeah.
Now we are facing the problem that we don't exactly know what happened because we haven't looked into it that much.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think it's a great moment, and we're going to learn a lot because we need it now. So now there's a need to understand it better, to use these tools better.
Yeah.
And probably these tools are also going to help us understand and study them in a deeper way.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was mentioned throughout the session is that maybe AI will be useful to study the patterns of involvement of these proteins in the brain and also in body fluids.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that sort of takes us on to the afternoon session I attended, New Era of Genetics in Movement Disorders.
Uh-huh.
And if there's any neurologist in this meeting that's going home and not quite sure about what AI is or machine learning, then I'd really recommend they watch Sarah Bandra-Sigger's talk at the genetics section, because the whole talk was great. But the first bit, she really went through what artificial intelligence is, what machine learning is, and, you know, how it's put together and how you know you can do it in supervised, unsupervised ways, and really explained it in a kind of straightforward manner. So I'd really recommend people looking at that talk to kind of get a primer if they wanted to sort of background to some of the other talks that have been in the meeting that have been talking about AI and machine learning approaches to sort of understanding things. I mean, in genetics, there are some. I mean, the problem in genetics, of course, is there's like a mass of data, a mass of, yeah, you know, data about variables in the human genome. And we're really struggling to kind of interpret that in terms of disease and to make interpretation both of what variants are causal for disease. And, you know, with so many variants come up in a gene like LRRK2, yeah, and we don't know which ones are pathogenic or not beyond a small number that have been validated to surrogate families. And then with genome-wide association studies, many genes are implicated at each hit because of patterns in the genome, and actually which one is the one that's important. And Sarah really kind of went through how AI can be used to train a system to produce interpretation of that, and then to help us to sort of decode the data. So that was a really great talk in that session. And then that was followed by Lassie Pilstrom's talk, mm-hmm, about epigenetics, which is, you know, tags that exist on the genome that control gene expression. For me, this is always a slight black box. I'm not quite sure. But he gave a great talk, again, explaining it extremely well. And then going to what people are really interested in is that if you had environmental exposure 10 years before, does that change the methylation pattern, the switching on and off of genes in the genome? And can we see a signature that indicates what you've been exposed to? And actually, I think that obviously is a big problem with environmental research, is that it's difficult to tell what people were exposed to 20 years before. But if there's a signature in the blood that you can measure, then obviously that would be extremely powerful. And Lassie gave a great overview of that. And that was then followed by Carolyn Sue talking about different levels of omics. And she, you know, RNA, protein, DNA, but she focused quite a bit on microbiome and obviously what's happening in terms of identifying different bacteria in people's gut, difference in Parkinson's controls, what this means in terms of clinical phenotypes. This obviously, you know, this is kind of a new and rapidly progressing area. I find it slightly confusing because there's so many different bacteria that I've never heard of that appear on these things. But again, she did a great job of trying to explain that and to kind of provide some interpretation that will help clinicians kind of understand this data that's coming through.
Great. And we normally, you know, over these days, as the theme of the Congress is AI, we've been also asking whether there is an AI pick of the day. We've been discussing AI since the beginning of this interview. So is there any other specific thing or take-home message on AI that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, I think, as I've said, both Dana Katabi's talk and Sarah Bandra-Singer's talk were kind of complementary. I mean, actually, the thing is how we handle very large data sets. And from Dana's talk, it's clinical data, it's measurements of people, massive amounts of data, and then training a system to pick out the relevant bits of this. Of course, things we don't even know about, breathing patterns that might be important in Parkinson's. So I like discovering new things by training a machine to look at massive amount of data, to pick out the relevant things, and then training it, retesting it, validating it, to try and get a tool from it. The genetics is slightly different because, of course, it's trying to pinpoint the main gene or the main variant. So we kind of know the biology, and that's where, you know, that's a slightly different problem, but they're kind of similar in a way. So we've got a massive amount of clinical data, we've got a massive amount of genetic data, and we need really computational tools to help us to interpret them. So,
stick. Was there any poster that you specifically want to highlight?
Well, I'm very involved in the Global Parkinson's Genetics Program. So we had a whole series of posters yesterday from the Global Parkinson's Genetics Program, which were great. Would highlight Catherine Stepp's poster looking at patterns of homozygosity, so regions of the genome that are the same from mum and dad's copy have both been inherited by the patient. And I think that poster really highlighted what we're trying to do in the Global Genetics, the GP2 program, which is actually looking at different ancestries, so looking at many different ancestries around the world, so not just looking at European individuals, but looking at African individuals, looking at South Asian, East Asian individuals, and looking at these different patterns. So trying to make this type of research global. And so, yeah, I think, but there were a whole suite of posters from the GP2 program. Along the lines of recessive disease, there was also a late-breaking abstract poster, which actually been up for a few days, but it was Francesca Magranelli's poster with the PSMF1 gene, so this proteasomal gene, recessive, been seen with recessive coding mutations in patients with early onset Parkinson's dystonia. But really interestingly, if you have loss of function mutations, so more severe mutations, you can have a perinatal lethal phenotype, so very severe perinatal disease. So there are different phenotypes with modification of this disease, and Francesca Poster contained quite a bit of functional data about how this affects mitochondrial function as well.
Yeah, and I mean, that poster was great. And also she had a talk in the late breaking abstract session, and she went also through the animal models that she worked on Drosophilas and mice, and amazing work, really.
Yeah.
Now let's go towards the end of this interview.
Yeah.
Well, we normally ask about other events that happen in the Congress, and I guess yesterday there's not much of a choice. If you have to choose one and pick one event, there's the event of the MDS Congress. It's very likely the video challenge.
Yeah. So the video challenge, again, is always one of the highlights of the Congress. It started off, I think, with very importantly with a tribute to Kapil Sethi. So Tony Lang made a tribute to Kapil Sethi, who he very sadly lost this year. And he's someone who really provided so much education, inspiration for people in the video challenge over the years. So that was a very important thing to remember him. Then moving on to the cases that now obviously chaired by Tony and Kailash Bhatia. They do a great job of chairing it, and the discussants did a great job of discussing things. I think this year there was a real kind of theme that they tended not to pick very rare genetic disorders and actually went for things which have got more kind of learning about kind of general medical things or environmental factors. So some of the video challenge years have been a new gene or a new thing. So this was slightly different. And in a way I think that's super instructive. So they had a case with lead poisoning. They had a case with facial movements related to cochlear implants. So they had, and again, when they did have a genetic case, there was a kind of link between the genetic etiology, but also a non-genetic etiology. So we know that there are some genes, proteins where you can either have an antibody or you can have a mutation in the gene. And so they had a case that followed that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was wondering whether I shouldn't spoil the, give the answers,
oh, yes, you're
give
right.
the answers. So maybe I won't. But anyway, that was a theme. And they had kind of general medical conditions presenting with movement disorders, which perhaps, you know, in the movement disorders clinic, we maybe forget about the heart, the liver, the kidneys. We don't think about this so much. But of course, this can be very important for our patients with movement disorders. So again, a great learning event and always a lot of fun to discuss things in the video challenge. So,
and just to remember the listeners that the video challenge cases are going to be published in the Movement Disorder Clinical Practice. They have been published for the last few years. And I'm pretty sure that they're going to continue doing so. So apart from looking at the session, it's a great idea also to take a look at the cases when they are published out. Okay, well, thank you very much, Hugh. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
We've been discussing a little bit longer than we were thinking, but I think it's been a very interesting and useful conversation, especially for people who was not able to come here. So thank you for joining me,
okay,
and thank
a pleasure.
You all for listening.
Thanks.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.